All right, so this lesson may not apply to you. You may be doing well in this area, and that's fine, but I'm not giving this lesson just for us. Hopefully this is a lesson that can also be used elsewhere for others, so maybe you can take this lesson to them as well. Imagine a wife talking to her friend about her husband, and she says of him that he's a good man. He does not drink, he doesn't smoke, he doesn't swear, he doesn't gamble. He has never hit me, he's never robbed a bank, he's never killed anyone. And her friend says, yes, but what does he do? Oh, well, he sits on the couch all day watching TV, but he's a good man for all the bad things that he does not do. Such reasoning is illogical. You can't praise a person simply for what they don't do. By itself, that is insufficient. It's like considering a house to buy and saying, well, this house does not have dry rot or black mold or things like that. But then you start to realize that it also does not have windows, wiring, or plumbing. Okay, so that's not a good house. And so you can't praise a house just based upon what it doesn't have. You have to also look at what it does provide there. The point is here that we cannot be content with what is called negative goodness, defining righteousness or goodness only by the absence of bad things or by what is bad. It is necessary that a believer in God abstain from sinful and destructive behavior. It's true. It's not true that everyone is automatically righteous simply because they abstain from bad behavior. There are many atheists and humanists who would also do the same thing or could do the same thing if they wanted to. That does not make them believers. So we want to be careful about how we look at ourselves or how we gauge others as well. Christians are defined by light, not darkness. In fact, we're told in Ephesians chapter 5, verse 8, that we are children of light. Light is something that is added to a certain context. You can't say that light is just the absence of darkness, because that doesn't make any sense. This absence cannot produce light. So if you think about it, as God puts us into the world as light bearers, salt of the earth, light of the world, or lights of the world, then we have something that we want to do. In fact, in Matthew chapter 5, 16, that's where he says, let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. It does not say so that they may see your omission of bad works and therefore glorify God in heaven. So there's something that has to be done. And if you think about it logically, we cannot promote God to a sinful world simply by not engaging in sinful deeds. There has to be something positive. There has to be something active that we engage in. Deeds of light, acts of kindness, acts of charity, godly virtues. These are the things that proclaim Christ to the world. So it's not just not acting like sinners, but it is instead acting like Christians, or more importantly, following what Christ does, acting like him. That's what gets people's attention. That's what causes people to think about the gospel. That's what inspires them. Okay? So you know as well as I do that our world is filled with sinful people and is becoming increasingly sinful. I don't want to get into all that as to how and what the details are, but the fact is people come to expect bad behavior. How do I know that? Well, this is why we lock doors. We put alarms on our cars and houses. We shred important papers. We put virus protection on our computers because we expect bad things to happen. We live in a world where bad things are expected. And that's a sad portrait of our world, but that's the way that things are nonetheless. Thus, we are not terribly surprised when bad things happen. But we are very moved and impressed by good things. Not just the absence of bad things, but when something goes in the completely opposite direction. That's what impresses us. I'm certain that it has impressed you. In fact, if you took the time, if you don't have it on your mind right now, you could probably think of some time, some event, some occasion in your life where you were in trouble or in need of help, and some stranger came along to help you. I just ran across a post on Facebook. Someone posted, some stranger somewhere remembers you because you were kind to them. Isn't that true? all of us have some occasion where someone was kind to us and we remember that person. We may not even remember all the details of what was going on, but we remember the kindness. That was an act, a positive act of godly virtue that was extended toward us, and we remember that. I've told this story before, but I'll tell it again in case you haven't heard. Our son was very sick a number of years ago. Sick to the point where he was losing weight. We were very concerned. We went to one specialist after another, a bunch of ER visits, everything else. It depleted our finances. We were down to $135 in our account. That was our joint account, savings and checking. We had no money. And then we get a check in the mail from one of my relatives, I won't say who, but from one of my relatives sent a check in the mail, unbidden. In other words, I didn't ask for it, and it's $2,500. Boom. That was exactly what we needed to get out of that hole. And I remember that. I don't remember the date. I don't remember, you know, all the details of that, but I remember the act of kindness. And I bet you do too. I imagine that there's something that you have done that you remember. Every time some bad tragedy happens, whether it's a shooting or a bombing, a terrorist act, a tornado, earthquake, something big on the news, some big bad thing has happened. We are shocked by the event, but we're also impressed by the unexpected rescue and kindness and good Samaritans that step forward to help people in need. Is it just me, or are there others that see that too? Okay, so you know what I'm talking about. So such acts of heroism and extraordinary kindness are not the mere absence of something bad, but they are positive action instead. Someone doesn't just stand by and go, well, that guy's hurt there, right? That's something that I would never hurt anyone. They don't, you know, as they're sipping their coffee, walking by someone in need. That's not how that works there. So among Christians, positive godly acts of kindness ought to be something that we perform on a regular basis. I don't mean that we keep track of them or that we have a certain count that we need to establish every day, but that we don't sit there and try to look at what we didn't do, but rather simply try to do what needs to be done. Everyday behavior, which would be expected of those who are born of God and conform to Christ. So we ought not to offer to anyone else or even give to ourselves an idea of negative goodness. Well, I'm not as bad as that guy. I haven't done all those bad. There's a lot of bad things I haven't done. And pat ourselves on the back for that kind of behavior. So you think about James chapter 2, verse 15 and 16, part of what was read here. If a brother or sister is without clothing and in need of daily food, and one of you says to them, go in peace, be warmed and be filled, and you do not give them what is necessary for the body, James says rhetorically, what good or what use is that? It's true. What have you done to show Christ to that person? We cannot offer words and ideas and hollow well-wishing in the place of what actually is needed. If someone needs food to survive, your empty, I'm not a bad person, is no help, right? So they need something of substance. They need your generosity. They need your act of kindness there. We can imagine another scenario, hypothetically, putting a bunch of empty plates on the table for your family and saying, well, we're not having any bad food tonight. Well, we're not having any good food either. So, you know, it's just a matter of how you want to spin that. But people need food to survive, and the absence of bad food isn't going to help anything there. So in essence, we do need the opposite of what wicked people do, but the opposite doesn't mean just the absence of wickedness. Here's what I mean by this. Look at Titus chapter 2, verse 11 and 12, for example. It says, for the grace of God has appeared, bringing salvation to all men, instructing us to deny ungodliness and worldly desires and to live sensibly, righteously, and godly in the present age. So here's the thing. In order to achieve the one, and in order to achieve the living sensibly and righteously and godly, we have to put aside those other things, that ungodliness and worldly desires. So there's kind of a letting go of one in order to grab a hold of the other. But suppose you just let go of the one and never grabbed hold of the other. Well, now you're just in the same boat as everyone else. In other words, of every other non-Christian. You're not doing what is expected. So it's true, you do have to let go of bad behavior. A lot of times Christians talk about, in the context of sinful behavior, they talk about getting rid of it, but not necessarily replacing it. And this is a big problem that we have been confronting in the church for many years, as long as I've been alive, I have seen this problem happen, where people have a bad behavior, a sinful behavior, and they keep saying, hey, I need to cut this thing out, I need to kick the habit, whatever the habit is, I need to stop doing this thing, but they don't have something to replace it with. And that's what Paul is talking about here in Titus. He's saying, not only do we carve out those things that don't belong in our life and get rid of them, but we have to bring the new things into our life that do belong and practice them. Without creating a vacuum, in other words, there's a lot of people, the world's logic is that it wants both. It wants to actually practice ungodliness and worldly desires and then wants everyone to be loving and responsible and good people, but it just can't work that way. God's system is far, far better than the world's. Here's another passage, Romans chapter 8, verse 12 and 13. So then, brethren, we are under obligation, Paul says, not to the flesh, or to simply the human appetite, to live according to the flesh. For if you are living according to the flesh, you must die. But if by the Spirit you are putting to death the deeds of the body, you will live. So there's things that we do in the flesh. Dealing with our carnal appetite, dealing with our human condition there, we have to put those things to death. Means we have to get rid of them. But we have to then fill that void with something positive, namely the fruit of the Spirit. That's another passage that I don't have up here, Galatians 5, verse 22 and 23. So we fill ourselves with that fruit, hopefully, and as we work in conjunction with God's Spirit. What we're saying then in so many words, if we're going to use the fruit analogy, we can't just keep picking bad fruit off of a fruit tree and then hope that everything's going to be good. Imagine you're a farmer and you depend on fruit trees for a living, and you have a number of trees that produce bad fruit, and you go pick all the bad fruit off these trees. But the problem is that they're bad trees, and they're going to continue to produce bad fruit. You can't just pick all the bad fruit off them and say, okay, good, now it's a good tree because I got rid of all the bad fruit. You see what I'm saying? And that sounds kind of ridiculous to think that way, but this is how people are. Sometimes we are ridiculous in our thinking, and so we think that way. We think, if I just get rid of all my bad habits, then I'll be a good person. But that's not what happens. That's not how good people are made, if you will. So instead of just picking off the bad fruit, what we really need to do is heal the tree itself. And that's what Paul talks about, is healing the tree and producing good fruit from a healed tree rather than picking bad fruit off a diseased tree. So if you can think about it in those very basic and simple terms, it works there. I don't have it up here, but in John chapter 15, verse 1 through 9, Jesus talks about the parable of his father's the vine vineyard owner, and he's the vine, and we are the branches, and our objective is to produce good fruit. Not just to be branches, not just to produce nothing, but to produce something positive, good fruit. In fact, he praises those who do produce good fruit, but he says of those who don't produce that they will be cut off from the vine and thrown away and destroyed. And so that's the master talking. That's not just church, our position on the matter. That's Jesus himself saying that. So we have a lot in Scripture that we can draw from to establish this point of something has to be done. All right, so I've been talking about concept all along. Let's talk now about practical application. We want to illustrate what we're talking about in everyday language. So we'll start off with the opposite of unbelief is not mere belief as a mere intellectual exercise of the mind. The opposite of unbelief is actually obedience of what you do believe. Putting that belief into practice in conformity with the laws of God. What we're saying here is that you can't just have an agreement with God, because no one's saved because you agree with God. Although you do need to agree with God to be saved, no one is saved simply by agreeing with God. Like everything that God said in his word, you go, yep, that's true. I believe it. That is the truth. He is right after all. And with that agreement, I am saved. That's not how that works. I do think people get this into their head sometimes that they think that way. That's not how that works. John 3:16, everyone knows that passage. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him may not perish but have everlasting life. That believes there, that word believes, is not a mere heartfelt desire. It's not just a religious conviction. No one's saved by a heartfelt desire or a religious conviction. The context of Jesus' words there in John 3, as well as the entire New Testament, speaks about belief in the terms of obedience. Obedience to the one whom you claim to believe. Think about it. You can't just say, I don't have unbelief, therefore I'm pleasing to God. The kind of logic there just doesn't work. It makes no sense. What pleases God is your active demonstration of what he's told you to do. All right, so the opposite of fear is not mere fearlessness, the absence of fear. I think there are a bunch of people, crazy people, I think, who are fearless. I'm talking about people who go rock climbing and skydiving and parachuting, sailing and all those kinds of things that I just look at those things and go, I don't want to do any of those things because, well, oh, right, I'm afraid of doing those things, all right? Those people don't have fear to keep them from doing it, and so that's fine with them. But that doesn't make them faithful. The opposite of fear is not fearlessness. The opposite of fear is living by faith. When we live by faith in God, we're no longer giving life to our fears and to our worries and to our anxieties. Someone might say, well, I have no fear of danger. But that lack of fear doesn't make him a man of God. And anyone can claim to have no fear, but the absence of fear is not an ideal objective in itself. I don't think God's praising anyone or patting them on the back just because they're fearless. However, saying, I live by faith in God, well, that means then you're no longer controlled by fear. Doesn't mean you don't have any fears. It means that you're not controlled by them. Because perfect love and a loving faith, or a living faith rather, casts out fear. But that requires some demonstration. All right, we've covered two things right now. What you should be asking yourself is, where do you stand in these things? What kind of belief do you have? Is it just the intellectual kind, or is it the demonstrating or demonstrated kind? And what kind of faith do you have? Is it just an absence of fear? You're not afraid of anything? Or is it actually believing and depending upon God? These are questions we should be asking ourselves. The opposite of lying is not saying nothing at all, but saying what is true instead, even when it is unpopular, even when it is unwanted, and even when, if necessary, unsolicited. We are told in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 15, that we're supposed to be speaking the truth in love. So it's not just a matter of speaking truth, but it is speaking that truth in a certain way. So what we're saying here then is that Christians cannot merely be people who don't lie. Although that too, right? There's that thing we have to cut out of our life, carve out. Lying has to go. Well, now what do we do instead? We have to bring truth in. And truth isn't just something you agree to. It's something that you practice. And it's truth is something that you say. Truth is something that you share. So we must be people who actively proclaim the truth. We need to know what the truth is and not afraid to say it, not afraid to show it. Again, you should be asking yourself, am I that person? Do I speak that truth? And do I speak it in the right way? The opposite of strife and selfish ambition is not merely sitting back and doing nothing. Imagine a church that is filled with people who sit back and do nothing. And then someone else comments and says, well, at least they don't have strife and selfish ambition going on there, right? Yes, well, they have little of anything else going on there either, right? And there has to be something positive being done rather than that. So the positive action that would be opposite of that would be sowing seeds of godly love and godly peace rather than sowing seeds of discord and division. Turn with me over to Philippians chapter 2 and you'll see what I'm talking about because Paul paints the picture here better than I can say myself. Philippians chapter 2 and there in verse 3 and 4 where he says, do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind, regard one another as more important than yourselves. Do not merely look out for your own personal interests, but also for the interests of others. That's what you and I should be doing. That's what Christians do. That's what they're expected to do. So we look out for others' interests, and that doesn't mean, we're not talking about interests in the sense of what kind of car do you like or what kind of food do you eat. We're talking about interests in the context here about what serves their soul's needs. We should set aside our personal earthly interests in order to take care of more important things for these people, instead of becoming a stumbling block or worse even, just someone who just doesn't care at all. We should be trying hard to set aside our agenda so that we can take care of others. And that takes effort. That takes demonstration on our part to do that. So it's not enough to abstain from cramming our own interests down someone else's throat. We need to pay attention and put forward others' interests instead, even at our own expense. So when I say that, if the world hears that, and by the world I simply mean the domain of the unconverted person, right? If that person hears that, that sounds like a very unnatural thinking. I need to set myself aside to help my fellow man. And here we are saying this is exactly what Christ wants us to do. It's a difficult thing, but it's a Christian thing. The opposite of being a thief is not the mere absence of stealing, but being a giver instead. It's not the mere avoidance of something bad. It is a lifestyle of doing something good. I'm impressed with Acts 10:38, for example. Peter is with Cornelius there, and some of the first words out of Peter's mouth as he's preaching to Cornelius and company is he says that Jesus went about doing good. All his life, he went about doing good. It doesn't say, Peter doesn't say, that Jesus went about not doing bad things. Okay? Jesus went about abstaining from a lot of very bad things. Well, that's true, but it's not helpful, right? It's true, but it doesn't say much about what needs to be done. Jesus saw needs, and what did he do? He set aside his interests in order to take care of those needs. He showed genuine godly interest in people, and in doing so, he went about doing good. Suppose a Christian, for example, would say, well, I would never steal, all right? But that person is a tight-fisted, stingy, ungenerous, and uncompassionate person. Well, it's hardly better than a thief, okay? So it's a lousy representation of Jesus. So yes, he wouldn't steal, but that doesn't make him a good person. If I'm not stealing, that doesn't make me virtuous and good by itself just because I refrain from stealing. There's things that I have to do in order to show virtue. Virtue isn't really worth anything until it's proven, until it's shown. If you think about all the fruit of the Spirit there, everything but joy itself, in a sense, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, so on, and we could add forgiveness to that as well. These are all things that are shown. They're demonstrated. They don't mean anything until they're shown. So it's something that has to be done. And I want you to examine your behavior just as I examined mine in this process and ask yourself, what kind of person are you? Do you judge yourself by what you do not do, or will God find favor because of what you actually do in his name that is in conformity with his son? The opposite of murder is not refusing to kill. I think we can all clear ourselves of that right here, right? So far as I know, we don't have any murderers in our group here. And so we're all good people because we have not killed anyone. I mean, that might be a logic someone might want to pursue there, but it doesn't make any sense. The opposite of murder is enriching the lives of others with godly love rather than taking those lives for granted and siphoning off other people's lives for one's own personal gain. That's the opposite of murder. It's not just the abstaining from killing someone. It is enriching their life with something that is very positive and very good. This has become epidemic in our society right now. I don't mean the murder part, but the siphoning off of other people. We're seeing a lot of people, for example, right now, there's help wanted signs all over the place. Have you noticed that? Everywhere you go. I mean, we traveled here this last weekend, and we saw help wanted everywhere we went. There's a lot of people staying home and living off the government, which people forget that the government actually has no money. It's our money, living off taxpayers so that they can stay home. That's siphoning off people. That's siphoning off someone else. That's kind of stepping on someone else to get to where you want to go. And while the world will not call that murder, it is the opposite of what a person ought to be doing. 1 John, for example, the whole letter of 1 John defines murder as simply withholding love from those to whom you are expected to show it. Think about that. In fact, if you will, turn to 1 John chapter 3, verse 11 and 12 that you have on the screen there. 1 John chapter 3, verse 11 and 12. John says, "For this is the message which you have heard from the beginning, that we should love one another, not as Cain, who was of the evil one, and slew his brother. And for what reason did he slay him? Because his deeds were evil, and his brothers were righteous." So he defines this attitude of withholding love as the attitude of Cain and the evil one here, which is Satan himself. So someone would say, perhaps, "Well, I'm not a murderer." Well, and I'm glad to hear that, honestly. It's good to hear. But do you show love? Imagine a Christian saying, "I'm not a murderer." But the question is not, are you a murderer? The question is, do you show love? Because if you're not showing love, Christian, godly love, to your brethren, first of all, and to your fellow man, secondly, then you're in the same class as murderers, according to what John just said. And that's not a good place to be. John puts the one who refuses to actively and visibly demonstrate unconditional love in the same lot with Cain and even Satan. And we certainly don't want to be in that crowd. The opposite of sin is not just doing nothing bad, but rather it is choosing to fill your own life with something that is good. Ephesians chapter 2, verse 10, for example, Paul says, "For we are his workmanship, created in Christ for good works, which God prepared beforehand so that we would walk in them." We're not saved just to be saved. We're not forgiven just to be forgiven. We are not brought into Christ just to be in Christ. We have these things done for us, and they're all good things, and we need them desperately. But we're not having those things done for us just so that we can say, "Now that is done, and I can carry on, as I was before." We are to serve as light of the world and salt of the earth in service to God through our positive influence toward others. We have work to do, in other words. We have the work of God to do. And there's no one else qualified on the earth to do this work but Christians. That doesn't mean that we're smarter than everyone, and it doesn't mean that we're more talented or more resourceful than everyone else. But what it does mean is that because we are saved, because we are forgiven, because we are in Christ, we are qualified, therefore, to carry out God's name to the world and show the rest of the world what God looks like through our own behavior. And that falls on our shoulders. And when I say our shoulders, I don't mean like everyone else's shoulders. I mean like your shoulders and your shoulders and yours and mine too. Everyone's shoulders. Every Christian is called to do this. It's impossible to live righteously or walk by faith by doing nothing. If you didn't catch that in the reading of James chapter 2, it's just impossible to do that. In fact, James chapter 4, verse 17, later on, he says, "To him who knows the right thing to do and does not do it, to him it is sin." Just think about what James just said right there. He says, if you know what to do, then you're wrong not to do it. And here, through negative goodness, we pat ourselves on the back for all the things that we didn't do. And James is saying, but if you know what is right to do and you don't do it, that's bad. That is wicked. That is sin. So we want to stress here that we're not more saved just because we do good deeds. None of us is saved by our good works. It's true. At the same time, those who truly believe that they are saved will show their good works in gratitude and obedience. Negative goodness is a myth. It is a sense of righteousness and justification based upon an illegitimate standard that leads to a false conclusion. So don't be conned by a gospel, a false gospel that validates only what we don't do, but doesn't expect anything to actually be done. We must not accept a gospel that puts atheists and unbelievers on the same page with believers. In other words, atheists and unbelievers can stop doing bad things, and so can we. But where's the difference then? There has to be something else. One thing that atheists and unbelievers won't do is they will not walk in the manner in which Christ walked. That's our job. That's what we can do. And that's what we are supposed to do. So, Galatians chapter 6, verse 10, let us do good to all people, and especially to those who are of the household of the faith. That's what Paul says here. He doesn't say, let us refrain from doing bad to all people. Although that's true, you should do that too. But that's not what he says. He speaks actively. He speaks positively. He speaks of things that need to be done, the demonstration of good works. So our focus should not be on what is missing, but actually what is expected by God. So what can we say to all this? Well, we can say this. Abstain from every form of wickedness, to be sure, but also pursue righteousness and whatever God says is good, because that pleases him, that serves the mission of his church, it actually serves the mission of this congregation, and it serves your own best interests. It is a win-win-win for everyone when we do it the way that God has prescribed. Again, I don't know if that lesson was particular to your situation. Maybe you've already caught on to this idea and you've been doing just fine. So be it. But maybe there's a message here that others need to know and that you could share with them as well. All right? If there's anyone here this evening that needs to respond to our traditional invitation, this would be your time to do so. Come forward if you need to.